Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
Well, my next guest this morning is a musician, composer and hugely sought after producer who wears his multiple achievements lightly. Rightly recognised as one of the top exponents of traditional Irish guitar playing, Steve Cooney enthralls his audiences with his performances. At the T.G. Cahir annual Grotham Ceoil event on Tuesday last, they're the Oscars of the traditional music world. He was awarded Composer of the Year. I'm going to be chatting to Steve shortly, but before that, he's going to play for us. Really lovely, Steve. Mirror of Justice. That's one of your own, isn't it? Tell me about it.
It is, it is. I wrote that for a local man. I live in southwest Donegal. This was a Kilcar man, James Jarrigo Byrne. He was a fisherman, and that was the name of his boat, the Mirror of Justice. And when I saw the boat, I thought it was just a beautiful name. And so I wrote that tune for James. And sadly, during the course of the year, he was lost at sea fishing and lost inside Tielan Harbour. So that's in memory of James Jarrigo Byrne.
Well, congratulations on your new award. I know you've won many accolades in your life. So where does this one rank?
This is great because it's T.G. Cahir. It's the Gaelic community. It's, and that means a particular amount. And also because the other awards have been for playing, which I do hugely appreciate, but this is for composition, for Camadóireacht. And it's a side of my professional life that I find deeply satisfying too. So I didn't know even people knew any of my compositions. So the thought that T.G. Cahir would have honoured me for an award for composition is deeply gratifying.
Well, Cogardicus. You have, however, previously cautioned, I know, against external validation for what you do. Why so?
thought, well, that's a good point, given that this is an award, and that that's exactly the point of external validation. I, in the context of that particular interview, I think it was individuals working towards their own goals who feel swayed by the opinions of other individuals who might say, oh, no, that's not, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. And that particular quote, the context of that was, always be true to your goals, stick to your goals, believe in yourself and believe in what you're going for, and don't be put off.
And I know the pandemic's been tough for a lot of musicians, but I was reading how you actually, I think you enjoyed not being on the road for a while.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I do love the road, but it can be exhausting. And then you'd find yourself sometimes, you know, filling up with diesel five times in a week. And sometimes, well, as I said, I live in Donegal. So if you had a gig in Cork and the next gig was 2 days later in Waterford, there's no point driving home. So you stay out on the road. And I do love life on the road, but to be at home was fantastic, to get a routine. And I was thinking, this is the first routine I've had since secondary school 50 years ago. It's like, get up, have porridge, go for a cycle, do a bit of work, watch a movie, go to bed, sleep in your own bed. I loved that sense of routine. And I found it very restorative, actually, to have a routine.
Mm. Now, you were born in Melbourne. But yeah. It wasn't, I think, were you 27 when you first came here?
I was 27, yeah.
Why did you come? What brought you here?
Well, I had gone to live with the Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory in Western Arnhem Land. And I'd gone up actually to learn the didgeridoo because I figured as an Australian musician, I should learn the Australian national instrument. And as part of that process, I was taken into the tribe, and then I went through a process of formal adoption and initiation. I got tribal scars on my shoulders, and I kind of went under law and was given names. So that is a sense of responsibility, where you are now responsible to the elders and what they tell you to be doing. And then the next thing they said to me, that if I really wanted to understand Indigenous culture, I should understand my own ancestral Indigenous culture, which meant coming back here to Ireland. So,
and remind me, for my listeners, what your background is from your mum and dad, where the Irish comes in.
The Irish is on my father's side. My great-grandparents were Irish, and I suppose post-famine they emigrated. They emigrated to Manchester, and they all met up in Manchester, and my father was born there. And then there was a TB epidemic in Manchester in the 20s. So my grandfather brought my father, which that killed my grandmother. So my grandfather brought my father out to Australia because it was a healthy environment. And I remember my father saying, you know, it's the first time he'd seen oranges and apples and bananas and fresh fruit and things like that. So they loved the healthy life in Australia. But he married my mother, who was the daughter of a Methodist minister, and it came from a great line of staunch Scottish Presbyterians and Methodists. And that didn't go down well with my father's father, who would have been very Republican, Irish, Catholic. So he disowned my father, and consequently all of my father's children, including me. I only saw my grandfather once. My father brought me out to see him, and I remember when I was a wee child, but I remember seeing the Sacred Heart lamp. It's an awful pity, because it would have been a chance to ask him about where the family roots lay and stuff like that, because all the time of the 40 years I've been here, I'm always trying to find some kind of hint of the townlands where they came from. But it would have been a chance to get family history. Never got that. But I suppose that was the times back then in the 1950s.
Thank God we've moved on from
exactly.
that.
Exactly. It's amazing how we've moved on, really, to be honest with you. Yeah.
So it would have been around 1980 you came here, depths of recession. What did you think when you got here? Was it what you expected?
I thought it was fantastic, because I had nothing to reference it against. Like, growing up in Australia, we always knew that Australia enjoyed an advanced standard of living, I suppose. It was I know in retrospect people are saying the 80s were hard, but it didn't strike me like that. It was just, life was hard, because you were out busking. I was busking on Grafton Street. I was saving up for Friday night fish and chips in Burdock. So saving up all week long for fish and chips in Burdocks, which I would go over to Cannon Steelyard to eat in the rain, because that's where Handel's Messiah was first performed. And I just felt part of the history of the country and the history of music and all that kind of stuff. No, but it didn't strike me as bad. But I remember one incident that stuck out the day I arrived. And I went into a pub, and behind and pinned against the bar was a printed notice saying, "No singing allowed." And I just thought, that is so fantastic. What a brilliant race of people, that they must be singing all the time, that they have to put up notices to say, "No singing allowed." And I subsequently saw that sign pinned up in lots of different bars. I thought, that is just so brilliant that they have to stop people singing. Because coming from Australia, that just no, you wouldn't get anything at all.
Was there a primary influence on you in terms of Irish music?
An Irish music influence? Well, the first I heard was, I had an elder brother who bought a Mary O'Hara record, I think in 1962, so I would have been, if he was born in 53, so that's 7, 9, I would have been 9 hearing that. And she remains to me today just the epitome of tasteful accompaniment. She was a beautiful singer. Her harp accompaniment to the songs was immaculate, the chord choices. And she had great humour as well, great humour in her songs. I have to admit, I was slightly disappointed when I came here and like hanging out with the cool musicians who kind of slightly looked down their noses at her as being a little bit too straight or a little bit part of a, how would you say that, Miriam?
50s, more conservative.
Conservative, yeah, that's the word. But I thought she was kind of wild and reckless in her own way. And she had quite a life, you know, great musician, singer, becoming a nun, falling in love, the husband dying, and then getting out and having another career. I thought she was fantastic.
When you say it like that, it should be a biopic at this stage of film. You know,
she would be brilliant. Yes, yeah. Absolutely brilliant. But so she was my first influence before I came to Ireland. And after I came to Ireland, I was like a sponge, listening to everybody and anybody, learning what I could.
And of course, then the sessions with the great Seamus Begley and the kind of understanding you developed when you two played together.
It was funny because we were total opposites. I mean, essentially a redneck and a hippie. Like, I mean, it was a complete hippie and he was a complete redneck. And he used to call us hairy and squarey, you know, and all sorts of other names. But we were diametrically opposed philosophically. And he's a farmer and he's got a farmer's attitude to life, and I'm a hippie and I'm a hippie's attitude to life. However, we were able to meet on a musical level, and the skills that I could bring to the relationship were complementary to the skill set that he had. So we weren't kind of duplicating each other in any way, because we had two entirely different skill sets, but they seemed to gel very well. And because it was a duo, we were able to be tremendously efficient. Like, with just a nod and a wink, we could make changes or change tunes or that kind of stuff. But I love playing with Seamus because we were able to get a very big sound between the pair of us. And we were never afraid. Do you know when you go on stage, maybe there's 3 or 4 different performers. I can't use the word acts, you see, because I have an ethical thing about the word acts, because I'm saying it's not an act, it's actually a genuine cultural transmission. It's not an act. An act by definition means it's false. And this isn't false, this is real. So if there were 3 or 4 different performers on the stage, you'd generally be pretty nervous that you don't want to be seen to be bad compared to the others. But I was never afraid with Seamus. We knew that we were going to, like, not necessarily win the day, but hold our own against a big 6-piece band like the Waterboys or anybody. We were playing Elton.
Tell me about the night in Ventry with Dolly Parton. Actually, in the late, great Port O'Shea's. I was just there recently.
Yeah, well, I'm told that the story has come down that Dolly walked into a bar one night and we happened to be playing. But as they say, you never let the truth get in the way of a good story. But Seamus and I had a regular Sunday night gig in Port O'Shea's, which was brilliant. And I loved Port O'Shea. I considered him a good friend. And also, he sacrificed to have music. He would lose money to bring the likes of Joe Burke, the great Joe Burke, rest in peace, down to the to the pub, because in those days you couldn't charge admission to the pub, so he would pay Joe and he'd lose money, but just have the glory of having music there. But anyway, we had a Sunday night gig. And the story that I understood it was that Dolly's manager was a Kerry man or had Kerry roots, and he was bringing her secretly to Ireland for a holiday in Kerry, and she wanted to hear real Irish traditional music. So so he arranged to come to the Sunday night gig. I think we got a message about the Wednesday or Thursday, you know, Miss Parton wants a table near the band, but not too near the band. So she came and we did our set, and then I went up and asked her, would she get up and sing a song? And she said, well, I don't think you know any of my music. And I had known one of her songs, Coat of Many Colours, because I had produced that in the studio in Australia. So I didn't know it really, but when you're accompanying, there's a lot, awful lot of bluff involved. You read the cues, you're always reading cues and predicting where the person's going to go. So she said, play it so. And so I had to play it, but she just shut her mouth and she wasn't giving me any cues at all. So my bluff soon ran out anyway. And she said, you missed that chord. And okay, sorry. But anyway, she was happy. And she came up and was tremendously professional. And it was great to play with her. She was a lovely, highly impressive woman and brilliant musician and great guitar player.
Look, Steve, as ever, I love chatting to you. Thanks for being Miriam, with me.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Congrats again on your Gardam Kill Award. And before you go, you're going to play for us again, what, two harp tunes?
Yeah, I'll play two harp tunes because I think it's important that guitar players face into the fact that they pluck strings, and that's what the harpers did, and that's Ireland's, the flowering of Ireland's national culture is the harp, and guitar players can access that. So this is two harp tunes. The first is for you. It's called Miss Hamilton, and the reason it's for you is because you've got roots in Kerry, roots in Kerry, North Kerry. And
my dad,
yeah. And so this was written by Con Lyons. Actually, he's in the books as Cornelius Lyons, but I'm sure he was known as Con. Con Lyons, he was from Ratu. This was written about 1706, Miss Hamilton. And I'll follow that with Éireann Lae, which was written by Tom Conlon from South Sligo about 1690.
Míle buíochas, Steve.
Go raibh maith agat. Thank you.
Today, the program was produced by Cora Ennis, Mark Dwyer was in sound, and our BCO was Sean Marram.